Welcome to Starfleet Universe On-Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I have an SCP Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us. We have Talkcast every Thursday night starting 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either join the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talk's website at www.talkshoe.com and search for Quality 17702. Or if you want to, you can join us on Twitch. So go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall and you can join the chat room there. You can watch the wonderful co-broadcasted video stream of my my screen and my lovely face. And hopefully I can improve the video there, because I've been working on it. So I just let you know, I definitely keep an eye on that, the Twitch chat room, so I can respond as soon as possible. Obviously, to me, there's a little delay there, just a reminder of that. And also, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to reach me via Twitter, my account there is SFUOnCall. Also, that's mainly for the podcast and announce things like tonight's topic. And of course, I have my personal account, which is Paul Franz. It's PAUFRNZ. And if you want to follow me, that's fine. Just a warning, I am proud to be Catholic and also a very ardent O's fan. And of course, I love technology. So those all together. Anything you don't like about those? If you don't like baseball, don't like anyone who espouses Catholicism, then don't follow me. And also, of course, I have an account for my business called Franz Games. So if you want to follow me there, I send out notifications of different things that are happening there. Also, this lovely Talkcast gets turned into a podcast available on iTunes and various feeds around the net. Some quick news this week from ADB, and that is, of course, the release of all the Shapeways miniatures. I'm not going to list them here because they're just too many. Just a minor note, which is there is a delay with the SIG variants because, unfortunately, SIG is also used by another manufacturer, and so currently they are under a copyright review by Shapeways. All fun. So moving on to Sapphire Star Tournament 6, it is completed with Andrew Koch coming out as the winner. That's with his win Ox Battle Cruiser. He beat another Fed, you know. It's crazy. We had four Feds and he defeated two of them. So obviously he's got plenty of practice killing Feds. And of course we congratulate Andrew on that. And I wish him the best of luck in future endeavors. When it comes to FedCom Library, sorry, there's not much progress there. Actually, there's no progress at all. It's still at 377 squadron-sized ships and 278 fleet-sized ship. And I will soon be releasing an update to the client, so hopefully people can enjoy some of the fixes for the fracks and also that one minor feature, which I think I mentioned last week. So with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one and only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we have me. Actually, we got Gary. How you doing, Gary?
I'm too bad. Hello to everybody.
Doing good. And Barry. How you doing, Barry?
Hey there.
So we got the Bopsy Twins.
Outstanding.
Well, the problem is when I got both of you on, your names are so close when it comes to pronunciation, Barry versus Gary. It gets tough sometimes.
That's Barry, B-A-R-R-Y. There are no E's in Barry.
I'm sure Gary's also spelled G-A-R-Y, so pretty darn close. Just you just happen to have one more letter.
There was a joke. There is a joke in that one, but I don't think you listened to Andrew Klavan, whose call sign is, and that's Klavan, K-L-A-V-A-N.
Oh.
K-L-A-V-A-N. There are no E's in Klavan. Like, okay, I can adopt that one. Very often people, I tell them my name and they spell it B-E-R-R-Y. So I've started telling people, B-A-R-R-Y, there are no E's in Barry.
Yeah, I have to spell my daughter's name out because like I speak, oh, it's Ellie. How do you spell that? E-L-L-Y. Not I-E, not E-E, just Y. So, anyhow, onward and forward. Since we have, and we have also Russ in the chat room on Twitch. Just a reminder, we do co-broadcast this on Twitch. TalkShoe and Twitch at the moment. And this is the reason, tonight is one of those reasons why I still have TalkShoe around, which is the ability to actually talk to people live and, well, not in person. I was going to say in person, but that'd be a lie. But anyway, Gary wanted to actually start with talking about Captain's Log number 54. The latest and greatest Captain's Log that is available for you to purchase from ADB. Which actually is really cool because of the story. Because the title of it is The Return of the Darwin. Which, if any of you know anything about the SFU universe, Starfleet universe. Not SFU universe, that's dumb. You know that what that refers to, which is the time when the Darwin actually went through a kind of, how do you describe it, Gary?
Wormhole.
Oh.
Well, in the original scenario, the original scenario by Christopher Cafiero, I think it sounds Portuguese, but I don't know if he is Portuguese or not. It's actually available as a hailing frequencies extra for SFB. So if anyone wants to download it, then you can go and find it there. Along with something else that ties into Seal 54 that I'll mention a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
Basically the scenario referred to it as a temporal rift.
Oh, okay, temporal rift. Okay. Yeah, I didn't think it was wormhole, but temporal rift, yes. That, you know, the Darwin goes to the temporal rift into the future, and a future which is very bad, temporal. Where the Andromedas actually have taken over the galaxy, or at least the Alpha Octant. I'm not sure how far they got around. I'm sure that'd be interesting to find out, you know, because we don't know if they took over the Sargassian part of the Milky Way, you know, and the other ones. Obviously, they probably took over the Omega, but, you know, the other part, other quadrants, octants, sorry, of the Milky Way. But anyhow, so, you know, obviously, it's a very nice one. Surprising, the person who actually wrote Return of the Darwin is Gary Carney. Hello, Gary.
Hello again, Paul.
So,
happy meeting you here.
We actually have the author right here, before us.
Well, for my part, it's the second time that I've been honored with a cover article, but this is the first time that it's been for a story piece, because the last time was I wrote a brief history of the Andromedan War in Captain's Log 49.
Yep.
So, that was more kind of like a quote-unquote history article, mm-hmm. whereas this one's more like, you know, but it still involves the Andromedan War, but more in terms of like the in-person sort of dramatization.
Mm-hmm. Which is always cool. That I find that difficult to do. That, you know, that is writing dramatization, you know, having a storyline, have the different characters, how they interact, how the relationships are shown through the words that are used in the story, you know, described, you know, And Lord knows, just a side thought, which is I do not envy any screenwriter who tries to take a novel and then write a screenplay based on the novel, because you know you have a limited amount of time when it comes to a movie versus a book. And the book can describe things in infinite detail. And certain things that can be quickly expressed in writing cannot be expressed on the screen. You know?
Yeah.
Well, one other thing is I should note that is there like an echo on the line for you? Because I can kind of hear myself.
I don't hear one.
Yeah, there's an echo. Let me try muting myself.
Okay.
How about that? No, it's fine. Okay. So I think, so I don't want to give anything away. Well, anyone who's like read the scenario probably knows how, like the gist of what goes on.
Right.
But I should note that one of the key things that fed into this story was the details that were given in module C3A for what happened, the timeline in the dark future.
Mm-hmm.
So like that timeline basically, you know, expresses key, it mentions key data points that take place in the 12 years that the Darwin is gone. So I wanted to basically try to lean into that to kind of emphasize what was going on in the Alpha Octave, that, like, you know, in the interim. So, because I think had that not existed, I don't think the story would have been, it would have been quite so, you know, I would have been able to have that kind of option. Like, it probably would have had to be, I guess, invented and stuff, which might have been a tougher ask. So,
mm-hmm.
And of course, when it comes to any story, like, there's always the editing process that it goes through when it reaches Amarillo and gets brought up to ADB standards. So,
agreed.
I guess no one can take... Everyone has to, of course they should, but everyone has to give at least partial credit to the Steves and Gene and everybody involved in, tidying up things and
making sure that
it fits the setting, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. And obviously one of the things that I know that Steve Cole is brutal about, which is, does it fit into the way the rules are? You know, is this possible? Is this a possible outcome given the current rules of SFP? Because, come on, we've all seen it with like Star Trek and different Star Trek movies where they invent, or the movies are books, where they invent this little twist, this little change, which might not be canonical for what currently is known about the Star Trek universe. But the writer says, "Oh, it'll be fine," you know. But it worked because it just helps me out so much and works out so well. And it's like, no, Steve goes, no, that outcome is impossible given the rules, you know. So, and which of course, some people don't. I know. I'm sure more than one writer does not appreciate. Because everyone can definitely change the way the story needs to be told. But it's, I think, players who want to play the scenario of that, of what's shown in the story, you know, one of the many scenarios that I'm sure you can actually have a story in, you know, in the captain's log that actually shows multiple scenarios, you know, that occur throughout the story. In which case, you know, the question is, can you come up with the same outcome realistically? It's always a nice thing.
And I guess one other thing I should probably note, because I'm hoping that, you know, people will get a chance to read the story and find it to be at least halfway decent. the one thing is that, I guess, because, we all know that, well, many of us know that much of the headline space has been taken up with the General War rather than the Andromedan War. So I kind of felt that, my hope was at least, is that the stories like this would not only help raise the profile of the Andro War in general, and also for the dark future in particular, because there's still the prospect of a future product that would basically delve for it more deeply into the dark future. For example, CL-54 itself comes with the Federation Commander version of the Return of the Darwin scenario. But I think it'd be interesting to see, like, when we ever get to Androbor in Fenn Empire, maybe if there's a way to kind of factor in the dark future in that, or even, like, for example, like, say, when we ever get to see the Andros published in Star Matter Rumors or Wars, or in a future book for Cult Arm Starfleet, how those, because I think, you know, those kind of game systems, maybe having like the kind of size of scenario involving battleships, like the Devastator battleship and stuff, I think that maybe those would really take to this kind of, you know, thing really well. That's a theory anyway, but time will tell how that works out.
Understood. That actually gets me excited, honestly. Of course, I like the Andromedans a lot. Big surprise there. And that is the whole idea.
That's a shameless plug.
Hey, what's my call sign on SFB Online? Andromedan. Thank you very much. Next.
I know.
To me, that gets me excited. The whole idea of possibly, and Lord knows, I would love this. I think this would be so cool. And that is the idea of basically going through the dark history. Let's say, for example, because the dark history existed because the first time through the history loop, the Darwin never went into the future. Because by the Darwin going into the future, it changes the future. It splits the timeline is what it does. If you think of the timeline as branches, all there's critical points in those timelines which change history, and depending upon how big of a change there was in the past, the branch might be a small little crook, or it might be a full big large trunk, division there. And obviously this would be a large division, but more to the point, it'd be really cool to see how the Andromedans basically defeated the Galactics, and see what would be the history of the Alpha Octant if that had occurred.
Well, I would advise having a check in Module C3A just to brush up on that. And also, I should also remind you that Module C3A also includes the four dissection beam variants, which do exist in the dark future, to include the Devourer battleship. And what a beast of a ship that is.
It's huge.
I shall put it more specifically. There is the kind of timeline that they do in certain products. But you're right in the sense that there's definitely a lot more detail that can be hammered out. That's one reason why, if you check on the BBS, you'll see a proposal thread or a discussion thread for the potential dark future product. So if that's the kind of thing that you want to see, then I guess raise your hand and just, hopefully in the not too distant future, there'll be a chance for it. Mm-hmm. But, there's plenty of other things to do with the Andromedans and stuff that, could be out there and stuff. That also exists in the standard timeline. Like, there's still plenty more. A lot of the ships that they would have fought in Omegas, or, for example, like X-ships or war cruisers and stuff, whatever, that don't exist in print yet. There's scope for them to be built up to basically allow for a more in-depth look at what the invasion meant there too.
So. Right. Oh, understood. But the reason why I get excited with the dark history when it comes to Alpha is because Lord knows, come on, let's be honest, everyone's honest here. And that is that there's so much product based on the happy, whatever, you know, the non-dark future timeline. I mean, so many ships that they've packed into that timeline that have been that are available or conjectural or whatever. You know, it'd be kind of neat to have the dark, expand on the dark timeline and say, you know, all these ships here, they don't exist because of the economies weren't there because of the Federation and the Klingons and all of them, all the empires have been dwindled to basically guerrilla groups that, you know, that would attack here and there through the Andromedans, you know, control of the galaxy, you know, so building ships makes it a lot more, heck of a lot more difficult to build a ship if you don't have these large economies, especially the Federation, which had the largest economy of all of the empires. I would assume that given the size of the Federation Empire.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what I was thinking is that when it comes to F&E, I don't know if it would. I think what would be interesting is that, like, say for example, you're the Andromedan player.
Mm-hmm.
You could give the Andromedans a running total, and then you could give the Alpha Empires a running total. Because so, say for example, like the Andromedans, they need to do a certain amount of, they need to reach a certain point, in which case they unlock the ability to start building battleships or start deploying the dissection beam. Whereas the Alpha Empires would have an alternate thing that they have to roll in order of basically sending ships on survey missions to try to unlock the secret behind the rapid transit network.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna, you can do it so that you don't...
Here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, see ya.
See ya.
So you could basically have it. So rather than having like a... like you could have two versions of a scenario where you either A... have the Darwin historically find the RTN windows, or B, have it skip ahead to the dark into the where it reappears in the future.
Yeah, but...
or you could basically do it so that you could kind of like do a sliding scale somewhere in between. So
mm-hmm.
you're actually giving the players themselves the agency to try to be able to find the network, mm-hmm. or you're giving the Andromedans the agency to prevent that from happening.
Right.
And so there's a lot more fluidity in terms of who actually wins.
Mm-hmm. Understood. So. Yeah, because. To my understanding of the story of the Darwin was the critical thing that the Darwin brought back was that the knowledge that this actually is a concerted attack by the Andromedans across the galaxy, and they have these things called, you know, they have this thing called the RTN, which, you know, allows them to quickly, you know, go around the galaxy with a small number of ships, and the existence of the RTN, you know, and so that's when you go searching for these nodes in the RTN network, and because that's when after the Darwin has come back. Am I correct in that, or am I wrong?
Well, there is a monograph that is in the Captain's Log 54 as well that expands a little bit more on the RTN. Kind of like how, like when the abbreviated... Is there another echo on the line again? I don't know. Kind of like how, like when the... back in Captain's Log 49, there was a main story about the Andromedan War, the history, and then there was like a monograph that ADB created about the intergalactic trunk line, which kind of basically... helps, you know, provide more context as to what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, there's like various other materials and stuff that talk about this sort of thing, like in, say, Module XNR and so forth. But you're really just going to have to read the story part.
Oh, understood. But I just want to make sure I understood the original context, because the reason why I ask is because of one thing. In that, if the Darwin is the coming back of the Darwin is the precedent, is the antecedent that actually causes the starting of the destruction of the RTN. Because of now the Galactics know how the Andromedas are doing their magic, basically. You know, they lifted the curtain, you know, and said, you know, this is how the magician is doing its trick, kind of thing. And because if the Galactics don't know how that's, how they have so many ships, you know, and they don't know about the network, then, you know, it's magic to them. So they don't know what to do to figure out, you know, how to stop it. You know?
And well, there is a data point. There is a data point in Module C3A which notes how that search basically. I'm really hearing a strong echo now. Basically, how that search pans out in the dark future timeline. So it's not that they never figure it out. It's just that by the time they figure it out, the starting point is so much further back than it is in the regular timeline that it's basically that much more of a hurdle to try to overcome.
Okay. That makes sense. In that case, what you're proposing of the die rolls when it comes to the network and discovering it and not discovering it makes a lot of sense then. In F&E terms, with what you described, you know, in the case of F&E Andromeda War.
Yeah. So, because I do think that it would be a little bit too artificial. Well, artificial is not the right word, but it would take. You know, so the thing is that, I mean, if the Andromeda War module would be balanced, then the Alpha Empires are supposed to win in the standard timeline, and they're supposed to lose in the alternate one. But is that really what you want, or would you rather that it toss up?
You mean for F&E?
Yeah, in the sense that like rather than basically just being giving a note saying, all right, it's a certain turn. Now you can start figuring out how to deal with the RTN, rather than having it be by your own actions, you've been able to build up enough survey points or whatever to figure out what's going on.
Right, yeah.
And also, you could even do a dynamic where, say, if one empire figures out the RTN, they still have to get a chip or get the information to another empire because the Andros are like... they're in effect blockading the empire from each other. So you'd have to almost like design a blockade runner or something like that and have it basically break, you know, get to the other side so you can tell, you know, the other people like what's going on. So with that, because like if you can't rely on subspace communications, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
So yeah, there's that. So once again, I hope that, people find the story to be somewhat interesting.
If they like the Andromedans, I think they will find it absolutely fascinating. So, still there, Gary?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. Okay. I was just saying. I think. I don't know if you've skipped ahead of it, but the next thing that might be worth looking at is there's a preview for gunboats in Federation Commander.
Ah, yes, gunboats attack.
Yeah, there's four sample ship cards, and there's also some rules basically detailing. Like the main thing to bear in mind is that compared to SFB, the move-in cost has been shifted to 1/8, but the gunboats don't have warp booster packs.
Oh, that definitely makes them gunboats. At least in my mind, because of... you know, that was one of the defining qualities of a PF was the booster packs.
Well, see, the thing is, the problem is that the movement cost that they use in SFB didn't necessarily work for FedCom. And I suppose the idea of having random engine damage, because one of the rules in Gunboss Attack is that the defending player basically assigns the damage on the Gunboss themselves. So it's not like there's no like, you know, like in SFB, there's like a separate damage allocation table for PS.
Yes.
That sort of thing doesn't exist in FedCom. So you basically just choose where you want the damage to be scored.
Which makes absolute sense because of that's just one of those things about FedCom, you know, because the original idea of FedCom, and when it comes to the damage allocation and changing the way damage allocation is done, I think my understanding is that it was changed to speed up damage allocation. You have, instead of having to roll 10 die, you roll like one die, and then you just follow the chart. Dun, 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 dun. You know, and anyone who's played SFB and played FedCom really thinks that there's not much savings when it comes to the amount of time for the die rolls versus a single roll. You know, especially if you have the experienced SFB player, he's basically got that chart memorized. The only reason he even marks anything down on the damage allocation chart in front of him when he's playing physically versus virtually, because if you play online, it's automatically done. It's done, you know, and voila. But in the reason why you even keep track while you're, you know, physically present is that you want to make sure that those boxes, which only can hit once and need to go on to the next item, you keep track of that. You know, so and that's the only reason they even use the chart at all. You know, because I'm willing to bet you there are people out there that are that, I'm not going to say smart, but they have the ability to actually memorize the chart and memorize the positions of each die roll in the chart and where that would be. You know, me, I ain't that smart. Well, it's not smart, but I don't have that ability to do that. But anyway, yeah. What else?
So another thing as well is that for now at least, there's no PF tenders and there's no variants, like no leader or survey or scout boats. They're all just like standard combat boats. Although each empire, it looks like they're going to get interceptors too, because there's a sample, I think we mentioned it in the previous episode, there's a sample of the Kurion Empress interceptor that's a hailing frequency is extra as well. And it has a movement cost of 1/16, but again, it also has no war booster packs. And so for my purposes, I think when it comes to, like, say, non-alpha settings, I think the, well, of course, the Andromedans, their mobile weapon platforms, they count as kind of pseudo-interceptors, and they don't have war booster packs anyway. So I could picture them, you know, being converted relatively easily to this system. But for Omega and the LMC, it would vary, because in the LMC, they have the Batavai are the only ones who have interceptors or PFs, and neither of those have war booster packs either. So that would be a relatively smooth conversion. But for Omega, things would be a lot more challenging, because they have those volatile warp engines, which work quite different to hot warp engines.
Agreed. That'd be interesting how that will work out. Because of unlike the PFs, they're not, which are basically, you can drop the warp booster packs. The volatile warp, you can't do that, can you?
Well, they don't. You're not able to use booster packs with the volatile warp engines. So the way it works is, okay, say for example you've got a Misron PF. It's actually 70 points, or say so 70 or 75 BPV in SFB. Like, it's a big unit.
Agreed.
It has two. Yeah. So it's got like 2 6-point volatile warp engines, but the trick is twofold. On the one hand, they have like an afterburner function, which is kind of like a budget version of Orion engine doubling. So when you run the afterburner, the engines output 50%. Each end outputs 50% rounding up additional power, rounding down. but you can only do it one turn at a time because there's an automatic cooldown on the subsequent turn. But when it comes to engine damage, when you don't run the afterburner, the engines take double damage when they're hit. When you do run the afterburner, they take triple damage, and a PF in Omega cannot repair its own engines. So basically, those kind of things might make it trickier to kind of like fit the template that's been put in for Alpha gunboats. Because mm-hmm. like I think movement cost 1.8 is way too good for that kind of engine. So my personally, now again, this is like maybe ages before this ever gets looked at, but my personal thinking is that an Omega gunboat might have to go to move cost 1.25. But you could then allow it to repair its own engines because FC doesn't really like having those kind of systems that you can't ever repair.
Right.
So, which also might be a challenge for the dissection beam because, of course, the dissection beam slices the thing off your ship. But if in FC, you'd have to try to figure out a way to account for that. It's not impossible, but yeah.
Yeah, that actually brings up a good question, which, you know, with the dissection beam. And that's one of those weapons that has yet to be migrated, converted, whatever you want to call it, from SFB to FedCom, other than obviously the you know, the Omegas or LMCs, which, you know, that are part of the official SFB. But, you know, That's another one of those things that is actually is an actual weapon, even though it's only part of the dark history. But that's another one of those weapons that has not been converted to FedCom.
Because you'd almost have to have, like, say, if you're using the laminated ship card, you'd probably almost have to have, like, two colors of dry erase marker. So mm-hmm. you'd use one color for your standard damage, which you can repair, and then use the other color for the dissection beam damage, which you cannot.
Right.
But I don't know, would players be happy with that? I mean, I don't know. But on the other hand, there's other game systems where it's much easier to, like, you know, remove things. Like, you know, the idea of damage repair, like, for example, like in a Call to Arms, is much you can do more lasting damage on a ship in that than you can in other game systems. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, maybe the dissection beam would work well in that more than it would in FC itself. So
It doesn't even need the special. In the case of the dissection beam and the FedCom, you don't even need a different color. You just need a different way of marking that damage. That's all. Because I'm not sure how much SFB you played, but when I was playing SFB, one of the ways people would actually damage their ship is when the damage was completed, when you done the damage allocation, you would fill in the boxes. But until that time, you'd mark it with a slash because you want to be able to recount the amount of damage allocation that has been applied to your ship so that okay, compared to the die rolls, okay, where are you in the die rolls? And in the case of dissection, all you'd have to do is, you know, just mark it a little differently on the actual ship card. That's all. Doesn't even need necessarily be a separate color. Lord knows, I'm sure.
Well, then this raises a side question. How do you handle dissection beams on the client?
I don't. That's actually one weapon systems that I currently... I have to double check. Because I'm not sure even the dissection beam is actually even in the client at the moment. Because I don't think anyone's done the module C3A ships. Because, though, I think the module C3A ships, they're basically, they are variants, correct? Yeah. Yeah, because there's no special ships that are just that use just the dissection beam, other than the monster one. Devourer.
Well, I think it would be interesting to one day see, because they do have rules for an X dissection beam, but none of the X ships that are in C3A use it. But it'd be interesting if, like, a future issue of Captain's Log or some other product offered that, especially now that we've got, like, Andro X ships on Shapeways.
Mm-hmm. Yep. which are pretty cool. I definitely liked what they've done with the Andromeda ships on Shapeways. So
yeah, there's I guess Dumbo's Attack. I think that's pretty much all we can cover for now, with it for now. But I think one other new thing that I don't know if you'd find it interesting or not is in the SFB portion of the issue. There are four variants for the Paravian of Omega.
Okay. Praven anti-proton heavy cruiser. Interesting. We got the anti-proton war cruiser and the anti-proton war destroyer and the anti-proton frigate.
And conveniently enough, all four base hulls now exist on Shapeways in 1:7,000 scale, as well as in 3788 and 3125 scales. Now, technically speaking, the ones that exist in Shapeways are the standard ones that have quantum wave torpedoes. Because, I mean, if you look at some of the miniatures for, like, say, the Warb and the Amatrians, they've actually got, like, dedicated, like, weapon mounts for the anti-proton lance and stuff. But that's the kind of detail you probably don't need to worry about. So you should feel confident using the current ships to represent the anti-proton variants too.
Right. Yeah, because Lord knows, most variants, you can basically just use the base ship, because unless you're really pedantic and gotta have the special dips,
So there are certain empires like the Hydrans and Trogrin that have distinct weapon mounts for their like different weapon types that are on Shapeways. So for example, the Trogrin have a torpedo cruiser and a bolt cruiser and a heavy cruiser,
right?
And they have distinct mounts to represent the implosion bolts or implosion torpedoes. So it does happen, but again, it's up to the collector to decide if that's important to them or not.
Right, and I can understand in the case of a galactic cruiser versus a regular cruiser, which is, you know, might be a variant, i.e., it has the sensor dishes basically, which are kind of more of an obvious physical change to the ship. Versus some other ones, which are, okay, you remove these two phases and they get replaced by drone racks. Like, how do you really show that? Because I'm not sure anyone knows what a drone rack, you know, looks like, except for maybe it's a little dot, you know, a little hole. Instead of a bip, it's a little dot, you know. And I said, unless you're really pedantic about, oh, it's got to be exactly like what it's supposed to look like, you know, and it's like, you know, you're taking this just a little too far, but some people are like that.
So yeah, basically, historically, it's noted that the Paravians basically discovered the old Yamatran homeworld in the seventh cycle, and within a year or two, they acquire some of the technologies for themselves. So this actually makes them the fourth empire in Omega to have access to some of these technologies, because the Warb, they're the ones that have like the big ships with the turrets, mm-hmm. and then also the Zosman Marauders, they can make use of these weapons too if they wish. Well, actually, no, the Warb use them, but then the Zosmans, if they're in warp space, they can take them. So the Paravians of Omega, this is basically a way to play test how the technologies work for them.
Right. I was just saying, I totally forgot that the Paravians escape the Alpha Octant and go to the Omega Octant. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, they actually come like a much bigger threat there than they would had they stayed. Like, because if you look at Module C6, even in the timelines where they survive. They're either a group of long-range raiders, or they're about the same size as the Hydrans. So they're not, like, that big a threat. But the ones in Omega become a very serious threat indeed. So, but anyway, what was going to... Yeah, basically, the thing to bear in mind is the anti... Especially the heavy weapons. The anti-proton weapons have a certain... you may notice that, like, if you're looking at Module C6, that Caravian ships tend not to have a lot of heavy weapon mounts.
That is true.
So it's almost like, I personally think it's because they're designed to land on planets, because a lot of those empires, like Sosman, Orion, basically empires that think in terms of being raiders rather than being, like, traditional, like, space empires, they have those kind of things where, like, they have fewer heavy weapons, but they've got lots of marines, so they can, like, board ships and stuff.
Yeah, well...
And bear in mind, the Caravian heavy cruiser has 20 boarding parties, so it's definitely not shy about that, so...
Right, but also, you think about it, the Paravians, at least the ships that left for the Omega Octant, were basically early, pretty much their early years ships. And my reason I say that is because... Mention that is because of the original Romulan ships, the old class of ships, you know, the War Eagles, the War Birds, the Snipes, all of those were designed to land on planets, you know, and so that's in the early years, you know, before, you know, transporters were the way to go. You would actually land troops on planets. You know, you land the ship and then disgorge your troops from there.
Well, I mean, it is true that, I guess, you know, depending on whether or not an empire is trying to become a more, quote-unquote, balanced, like, empire for operations in space, like, to be, like, a regular navy, as opposed to wanting to retain the ability to launch raiding forces. So, I'm trying to think, like, for example, like, I guess there's a few other empires, like the Sigvarians and so forth, because they have a good reason to want to land on planets, because they want to spread the Sig virus to new targets or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the thing I wanted to refer to is that...
Did you see the issue with Shapeways and the Sigvarians?
Yeah, apparently the term Sig... it's used by some other company for, like, a totally different thing.
Yep. It happens, yeah. You know, conflicting terms, you know, for two different companies, and they mean two totally different things. So I thought I'd bring that up.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, there is actually a Sigvarian scenario in CL-54 as well, so that might be worth keeping an eye out on.
Mm-hmm.
For SFB, I should note. Basically, now the thing to bear in mind is that when it comes to the Amatrian weapons, especially, like, the phasers are one thing, but if we're talking about the heavy weapons, you've got the anti-proton beams and you have the lance. Now, the beam just takes a single weapon point, and it can be installed on a range of different sizes of ship. Even, for example, the Warp, they put them on their PFs as well. So you can, you know, it's fairly flexible. Now, it's a two-turn arming weapon. So it costs 2+3. You can hold for one. It does 2d6 in terms of, like,
right,
rolling to, like, what your damage is. But the actual average damage isn't that great. But the lance, on the other hand, it can only be mounted on size class 3 and above. And that's the Amatrians, because they're crazy enough to put it on a smaller ship and then watch the ship shake itself apart through shock effect.
Mm-hmm.
But the lance is basically, it takes up two adjacent center line option mounts, and the way in which it works is that it basically doubles the damage from up to three beams that are fired from the same ship at the same target in the same impulse, technically anything within the same front hex row, but the way in which the math works is that having, like, say for example, like, say if you've got, like, a ship with only three forward mounts, and you put a lance in two of them and then a beam in the other, that's actually worse than just taking three beams. But if you have four forward slots, then if you take two beams and a lance, then if you can line up your opponent in the center line, you can basically do the damage of four beams for the cost of just under three.
Wow.
And ideally, if you have five mounts, you could basically put a lance and three beams. So then you do the damage of six beams for the cost of just under four. Because the lance charges for 2+2 as a lance.
Right, right.
So the trick is, if you have the beam and the lance, you either have to put it on a ship that's agile enough to try to line up your opponent. So the Amatrians and the Zosman Marauders and the Paravians have heavy cruisers with terminals of B. So they can, not be entirely bad off. But of course, if the ship is agile enough, they can try to keep out of the lineup. But for the Warb, their heavy cruiser is really more of a heavy battle cruiser. It's got a turn mode of E, but it has the turret to help do the turning for it.
Right, right.
So there's basically those kind of things and stuff. So it's not a magic bullet by any stretch, but the perspective of the Paravians, who, my assumption, now, this hasn't been confirmed in the material in CN54, but my one of the plans I had was that, because in CL50, if we look at CL50, it came with rules for the Zosman Stealth Field as well as for Zosman SDs. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until CL52 before we were able to actually have a proper update file, which actually gave you proper information about how the Zosmans work.
Right, right.
So I was hoping that at some point there'd be a similar update file, which will basically hammer out how the Paravians of Omega work, including basically clarifying, because I would see them using the same quantum wave torpedoes that you see in Module C6. But technically speaking, that hasn't been confirmed yet. I would say that, yes, they do. And actually, I would let the Zosmans use that too, the ones that are operating in Paravian space. So the thinking was that some of the variants that you'll see in CL54 is that you would have a mixed squadron, kind of like the way you have with the Hydrans or Tholian or Troban or whatever. You'd maybe, for example, say if you're doing a war destroyer squadron, you'd have a standard war destroyer leader with quantum wave torpedoes, and then maybe one or two war destroyers with quantum wave torpedoes, and then you put your anti-proton variant as a mailed fist, if you can basically use it to score direct fire damage that you wouldn't otherwise be able to.
Right.
So, because my thinking was that since you have ships that have relatively few weapon mounts, or phaser mounts for that matter, for some of the smaller ones, I was thinking that it's better to have each ship optimized for its specific role in a squadron, rather than trying to have a single ship be a jack of all trades.
Right. I was wondering if that's where you were going. Yeah, I think that'd be great. Basically, the whole idea of you have the different strengths when it comes to the different ships, and they're meant to work as a fleet, in concert as a fleet, with the different strengths, whether it's, the quantum wave torpedoes or the anti-protons,
So it's kind of like how, only the Troban cruisers are big enough to have the luxury of being able to mix up their weaponry with the implosion bolts and the torpedoes. But the frigates, basically only the frigate leader has a mix of bolt and torpedo armaments, but the standard frigates, you basically, if you want a frigate with implosion torpedoes, or you get a frigate with the bolts. But, it's not a magic bullet for the bolt one either, because even though the bolt has certain advantages, it costs a lot of energy points to keep it up and running, at its maximum level. So that's kind of like, I worry about, for example, if you're using those Zosman Marauders, it's kind of like with the Orions, where it makes more sense to optimize each ship in a pirate squadron to do a certain role.
Right.
Because you only have so much to work with in the first place. That's my theory anyway. Because there's definitely scope for other people to, think better if they have an alternate way, which I'd be happy to go with, if that's the way forward. So.
Right. And actually, the one thing that it definitely brings up a question, because one thing you as you was pointing out about the Zosmans and now the Paravians and the current captain's logs, is that Is ADB slowly bringing out these this playtest material, because that's what's in the captain's log, is basically playtest material for these different Omega empires, and then a year, maybe 2 years down the road, they actually going to release a new Omega module because of the.
Well, I'd like to see that happen, but I guess it depends on, you know, what the player base says and also what the logistics say, because it's looking like things are looking good for the counter sheets, especially because I think they're going to be running a bunch of counters for things like Module R4T.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, anyone who gets a copy of the Tholian Master Starship book, it actually has all of the ships that are going to be in Module R4T in it.
Oh, can
so
you
you'll actually be able to preview of what to expect.
I'm an idiot, and I don't know. I'm not in the know, and Lord knows, I realized that when a person who texted me and went, "When's R4T gonna come out?" It's like, well, I have no idea, because I have no idea what R4T is. What is R4T?
It's basically okay. So usually, whenever the ADB does like a new Master Starship book, a couple of new variants that never got handled before kind of fall out of the woodwork. So, right. For example, when the Kazinti Master Starship book was done, they basically did a few destroyer variants that are actually in CL-54 now. But with the Tholians, there was a ton of there was a ton of units that basically fell out of the woodwork that had yet to be done. And so rather than basically put them into a captain's log, they basically decided to create a whole new mini module, which is going to be called Module R4T, and it's going to include a bunch of new SSDs. And from what I gather, it's going to have its own little counter sheet as well.
Oh, cool.
And so, yeah, that's basically something that's maybe worth looking for.
Okay.
Oh, and actually, I should also point out that the Tholian Master Starship book is really interesting for a number of reasons. One is it has the stuff from R4T, as we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Two is it consolidates all of the early years material, including two of the background articles about the early Tholians that were in Module Y2 and Y3.
Ooh.
And it includes the Tholians of Draco story from CL-39, although unfortunately it still doesn't include the Sojourner survey ship that is the star of that story, because I really want that ship.
Oh, jeez.
But it also comes with the big, most in-depth look yet at what the Tholian Empire looked like back in the home galaxy prior to the revolt.
Oh.
So it basically gives you like a list of like the ships that would have served there, also a list of the civilian units that the Tholians themselves would have used.
Oh.
And then ones that they allowed their subjugated species to use, because things like bulk carriers were like beneath the Tholians' own handiwork.
Right.
But they were like, they did allow their subject species to use some of them. So say, for example, if we ever get to the point where we see more about the pirates that were in CL-40,
mm-hmm.
there's a much more in-depth look at exactly what it is that the pirates are pirating in terms of like the target colonies and convoys and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
definitely sounds.
Oh like, yeah, so basically,
I definitely have to get that module when it comes out.
Oh, the PDF is already out.
Oh, okay. I have to then look for it in my local ETA.
But yeah, I said the PDF for the Starship book. I meant as in like the R4T hasn't been shown yet.
Okay.
But there is also a preview in Captain's Log 54 about another upcoming mini module that is called Shadow of the Eagle. And it's basically a look at what the Romulans would have looked like if they had figured out how to develop warp travel by themselves. Which I personally think would be interesting if it basically has any kind of overlap with the Paravian stuff for Module C6. But I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. Well, if the Romulans had developed warp technology by themselves, that definitely would change things drastically. Yeah.
So, yeah, basically it includes, I think I mentioned there's a couple of sample ships one from the Y era and one from the W era for those Romulans that's in here. There's a Y royal bird and a W king bird. So the royal bird is basically has two plasma G torps instead of having an R torp. And the king bird is basically kind of like an early ancestor of the king eagle. So it's a command cruiser with a plasma R.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's one thing I always thought was a... Oh, that was awful. Which was the early... What happened with the early Romulan ship, or was it the Y-era ships, where basically ADB did something really bad, and they named, was it they named the ships or used the same nomenclature for two different ships? You know, one actually is in the general era, and the other one's in like the W or early years. I forget which. It was like, not the Warbird. I think it was Vulture. I think it was. Well, in the early years, the Vulture was a dreadnought. And then later on, I think Vulture was used again for something else.
The Vulture is the same hull, actually. It's just that in the early years products, you see the sublight version of the Vulture. Whereas in Module R7, they show the Warbird with, the Vulture rather, with tactical warp refits.
Right, and it's still called the Vulture. And it's not like, I don't know, the Vulture Plus or whatever, unlike the War Bird versus the War Eagle. Because the War Eagle, that's basically a War Bird when they added the warp engines.
Well, they do have the War Vulture and King Vulture. That's how they refer to it.
Oh, okay.
But I got to be honest, though, like before the Mongoose deal, I was less particularly impressed with the Hawk series ships like Sparrowhawk and stuff. Now, I know people like the classic design, and that's perfectly fine. But for me, as in like the concept of like the Romulans developing some other way towards modern warp, I wouldn't have really been, put out all that much. But ever since Sandrine created the Mongoose-style Sparrowhawk, like a ship that looks so cool, it really embodies the idea that this ship was designed with influence from the Klingons, but is definitively a Romulan ship.
Right, right.
Ever since that happened, particularly, it's like really embedded in my mind the concept that this is basically how things should go. And so I'm less excited about the idea of there never being a Hawk series in some alternate Romulan timeline than I would have been had it not been for the Mongoose version of the Sparrowhawk and just like the Firehawk and stuff. They were showing, what that design could reflect,
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed. You got a point there, which is the whole idea of it's not basically if the Romans had discovered and figured out basically tactical warp, which is what we're talking about, that they might not have had the Klingon influence on modifying their ship designs. When it comes to when they got tactical warp. Which in the normal timeline is from the Klingons. There, when it comes to
if you think about it, if you look at say the Winds, I mean, the fish ships probably wouldn't look the way they would if it wasn't for the fact that it was an Orion shipyard that the Winds took over to build them.
Agreed.
Or the fact that they were basically importing the Klingon engines to put on the fish ships. So, there's those kind of now, fairness, Klingon technology shows up in a lot of different places. So, maybe it's okay to not be too tech slushy. But on the other hand, I think it's good when it actually makes sense and builds towards something, like as we see with the Hawks and stuff. But to be honest, I actually think it would be interesting to see an equivalent of Smarba, but with the Paravians rather than the Klingons. Mm-hmm. So, because if you look at the Paravian, like, especially if you look at the new Shapeway ships on for Paravians, you could easily imagine that thing with Romulans flying it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Understood. Yeah, I agree. Okay, the question then would be, if the Romulans didn't have the Klingon influence when it comes to their ship designs, what would, you know, would they still stick with the same kind of old style ship, you know, that the War Eagle and the Snipes and all and the Hawks and all those series of ships were? I'm talking about the like the Chicken Hawk, you know, the classical old Romulan from the original series kind of thing. What would the next generation look like? You know?
Well, I guess that's the thing, because then you'd have to think, I mean, I'm sure, like, there probably is at least some timeline out there where they do basically look like the same thing, but just maybe a little bit sharper. But then, I don't know. I mean, there is a fan base for that, of course, but, you know, I like it when the SFU basically opens the door for something that's different, but that still fits properly, you know.
Right, because obviously one of the big changes when it comes to when the Klingon influence is actually, if you think about it, is the turn mode. The Romulan ships became more maneuverable, you know, when it comes to, you know, being able to turn and so forth. So versus the old Hawk ships, you know, where they're relying basically on their big guns flying towards the opponent, and the opponent can't outmaneuver a plasma torpedo, you know, which was the philosophy for the old ships. At least that's the way I feel like it is. I'm talking about the old Romulan ships, obviously. But, you know, would they have figured out that you need more maneuverable ships without that Klingon influence?
Well, I suppose if they'd gotten their hands on some Paravian ships, they're pretty agile too.
Agreed.
Although they have less room for plasma warheads, because like a Paravian CA has just four forward mounted weapon points, so you could turn that into two plasma S torpedoes, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to match like a K7R where you have like two S's and two F's. Mm-hmm. Like, there wouldn't be the room to fit the F torps. So you'd be leaning more heavily on the ship's phaser arc. But I mean, like that in itself may not necessarily be a bad thing either, you know. Like, it might maybe, what, for example, like, you know, we were talking about the idea that Paravian ships are built to land on planets. Well, what if Romulans designed a third generation series influenced by the Paravians that did not have to land on planets and therefore had more room for, like, you know, a more balanced space superiority ship? So, I don't know.
Understood. Huh. Interesting. Well, it's interesting to think about, you know, the what the possibilities are when it comes to the design, the ship designs, and how they would be modified by the change in history. Really is. But in any case, I think it's about time to wrap it up for this evening. Gary, it's been a pleasure having you around. Don't make yourself a stranger.
Thank you. And of course, if there are people out there who are interested in trying out these new Paravian ships, either against pre-existing ships or against the Andros or Soldra or against the Zosmans or even the Federal Republic, you could basically have a battle of the blow-ins from Alpha. Because I think that would be like an interesting thing. Like, I mean, like, how would these ships basically do against the old Terran designs of the FRA? There actually are, like, I mean, later in the timeline, the two of them do fight. So there's definitely scope for that there.
Mm-hmm.
So, so basically, I just hope that these little steps, like, even if it's only four SSDs at a time in an issue of Captain's Log, that they're helping you know, provide little stepping stones towards something new and exciting for Omega going forward.
Right. That's why I posited the whole thing about some, you know, in a few years, you know, having enough material from the playtest material and enough people hopefully playing it, at least maybe getting some response to ADB, or maybe, you know, the people, yeah, enough people playing it, hopefully, that they'll get some response and get at least an idea if it's good or bad, and then actually make a new Omega module out of all, you know, a lot of playtest material and some additional stuff that they would add on to it, of course. But, you know,
and the handy thing about Omega now being in 7,000 scale is that it's a lot cheaper to, you know, get a sample lot going for it in terms of, like, say, like if you buy that, say, that Paravian 1 to 7,000 thing, you can, of course, use it in the alpha with the module C6 stuff. And now you can use it in Omega. And then if you want to go have them go against a Trobriand squadron or a Meswan squadron or whatever, they're available for you. And, you know, hopefully, like, I mean, because I guess if you go for the cheaper material, it's not that expensive, although I personally prefer to stick with the smooth blind detail plastic, but, you know, it's entirely a personal choice. So, but yeah, the options are out there, so hopefully people like them.
Okay. Well, Gary, with that, you have a good night.
Have a good night, Paul.
Okay. So, I had a nice discussion about the Caps Log number 54, some of the, of course, the Andromedan War stuff, which is always interesting to me, big surprise, and some talk about alternate histories overall, you know, from the dark history line when it comes to the Andromedans to alternate histories when it comes to the Romulans and how that might affect things, and including ship design. So, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.